Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we will be picking up on a topic that we do each month on the show, always on a Friday, and it's money management and financial issues, and we've been doing this now for quite a long time. Our guest, regular guest, is here. His name's David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the College of Business here at the U of I, and as I say, stops by every month, always on a Friday, and we talk about various kinds of topics that have to do with investing, financial planning, and money management. Also, we have a special guest here this morning on the program who has actually been here on the program before a couple of times. His name is John Masetich. He's a professional money manager. His firm is called Kensington Financial. He makes his home in California. But once a year, he comes here to Champaign-Urbana, and he teaches a course. He's also an adjunct professor of finance. So he stopped by, and the two of them are here, and we'll share the benefit of their expertise as we talk about personal finance. And at some point here, certainly, we will also be opening up the phone lines. I don't, usually what happens is Dave makes a few comments here just to kind of start out. And then if people have questions about that or anything else in this financial planning realm, I know that both Dave and John will do their best to help you out and answer your questions. And then you can take that on from there. I say it, particularly at the end of the program, is we want people to think very carefully about their financial planning. Get as much research as you can. Do many opinions. So we would never want you to do something just because these guys said to do it. But this can be one piece in your research, giving you the opportunity to talk with him. So having said that, I say to both of you, welcome to the show. Glad to have you with us, and you can take it away.
Well, good morning, David. As always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you, and good morning, John.
Thank you.
I'm delighted that you're joining us this morning. Now, the first thing that I usually do on my list is to talk about the couch potato portfolio. So let's jump in. Now, it has been listed on the website of WILL, so the actual asset allocation among the S&P 500 and large value, small cap value, the mid caps and the internationals, that actually exists, as I understand it now, on the website in terms of its allocation. But the issue is, well, how did we do last year? What did it really wind up as of December 31, 2005? And frankly, I'm rather pleased to present the fact that we ended up with 12.08% rate of return for the year. Now, keep in mind that included dividends as well. So that's just a little bit over 12%. I'm pretty pleased with that, especially when we start to look at some of the other indexes, the S&P 500 for the year, some of the bond indexes that we're going to look at as well. And of course, the question always arises, well, as of January, where are we at? Well, through yesterday's close, although today it sounds like the markets are a bit dicey, they seem to have moved a little bit south, at least early in the trading, but at least through yesterday's close, can you imagine our couch potato portfolio is up 4.49% for the year? My goodness, that's more than the annualized treasury rate on a five-year treasury at the moment. So now I'm going to talk to John just a moment. I want to tell you that he's a good friend. He's a heck of a money manager. And what I'm really impressed about is that he and his lovely wife, Grace, come out here in the dead of winter, although it doesn't seem like that this year, and leave the friendly confines of San Diego with all of that nice weather. And John comes out here and teaches a course in financial advising and planning through the College of Business. And this semester, I believe, has over 125 students in one course who just are waiting with bated breath, I guess, to get those pearls of wisdom from John. So, John, let's talk about bonds. Maybe let's talk about the international markets. Where are people going to place their bets in 2006, for example?
Well, thank you, David, for that nice introduction. I still think the international markets are a good place to be for a certain percentage of your stock position. I'd like to just rattle off a few performance figures for various countries last year. It was, as you said, a very good year in the international markets. In local currency terms, South Korea made about 55%. Denmark made 41%, Norway 35%, France 26%, Germany, 25%, Sweden, 30%, the UK made 17%, and here in the United States, using the S&P 500 index, we made about 4.5%. I think the average foreign stock mutual fund based in the United States made somewhere between 15 and 16%. So it was an excellent year. And I'd like to address, just if I may, for about a minute or so, the European markets. You know, when you think about Europe, that conjures up certain images in most people's heads. That maybe the first thing you might think of are, you know, quaint villages in Europe, you know, outdoor cafes, you know, all those sorts of positive things. But on the financial side, I think more likely you might think of a term the Wall Street Journal likes to use. They call it eurosclerosis, meaning, you know, Europe is overtaxed, overregulated. And that's true to a certain extent, to a large extent, actually. So how do we explain, then, these wonderful returns? I mean, Scandinavia turns in returns. Every Scandinavian market was over 25% last year in total return in local currency terms. And Germany and France, the two countries that are definitely overtaxed and overregulated, also turn in extraordinary performances of 25 or 30%. And I think that, you know, the reason for this wonderful performance is that markets are anticipatory. Markets are not looking in the rearview mirror and saying, oh, you know, Europe overtaxed, overburdened. But they're looking ahead. And in Germany, for example, we have a new chancellor, Angela Merkel, the first female chancellor in history of Germany. And she is a member, she leads the conservative party, the Christian Democratic Union. And she and the CDU promised to bring lower taxes, less regulation. So the market's very pleased about that. The same is true to maybe a lesser extent in France, that they are privatizing a lot of formerly government-run companies, and tax rates are going down. And in Scandinavia, there's another area that we think of overtaxed, overburdened. And yet in Scandinavia, there was a chart in the Wall Street Journal recently, and it showed that corporate tax rates in Scandinavia are actually less than in the United States. Less than. I think in the United States, the average corporate tax rate is about 34%. In Scandinavia, it's about 30%. And so, and there are some, you know, great companies that in whose stock you can invest in Scandinavia. So the markets are looking ahead. Capitalism and less government and privatization and corporate reform are the norm today all over Europe and in Asia. And that, I think, explains why the foreign markets did so well, not just last year, but in fact, the foreign markets have beaten the U.S. market 5 of the last 6 years.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, I'm looking at the indexes last year, the total international index, at least the Vanguard total international index, it was up about 16%,
yes,
as you said, and emerging markets, depending upon which countries you call emerging markets, it was up at least 32%, and it's just jumped right out of the box this year up about 8%. Tell me, in terms of your client portfolios, what kind of percentage allocation do you have in international stocks?
Well, if you look at just our total stock positions, I'm not talking about a percentage of your net worth, but if you just look at whatever percentage you have in stocks, I'm running about probably 30 to 40% in the international markets with the balance in the American market. And most of that 30, 40% of the total stock position is actually in the developed markets, not the emerging markets. The mortgage, I think everyone should have a little bit in the emerging markets, but I think it should be a fairly low percent. They are very, very risky. But by the developed markets, I mean the well-developed markets of Europe, you know, the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and so forth, and Asia. In the larger, more developed economies of Asia, like Hong Kong and Japan, Singapore, Taiwan, and so forth. So I think there is a place for the emerging markets, but I think caution is the word here. Anytime anything goes up 30, 40%, look out.
Well, no question about things have this habit of regressing back to the mean. Now, in my couch potato portfolio, John, it might be you might want to criticize it. It has 10%.
I think that's reasonable,
funds.
Actually.
Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I think
that's so somewhere between 5 and 10%.
Sure.
Is that sort of the bogey?
Absolutely.
And 20% really in these larger developed or this total international index, if you will, which is really more of Europe, Australia, Japan, et cetera. So you'd feel comfortable with that.
I would, as long as that section that you call emerging markets is well diversified. In other words, you don't want all of your money in, say, Nigeria and Turkish stocks, you know. fine countries, but they're very risky markets. So you want to, you know, a whole array of emerging market stocks, and you probably want to play this through a well-diversified emerging market mutual fund based in the United States.
Okay. Now, it's no secret that bonds had a fairly tough year last year, unless you were really in long-term bonds. Short-term bonds, maybe 1%, 2%, 3% up for the year. In terms of your overall asset allocation with your clients, if a client hands you just a dollar and says, I'd like you to allocate that, how would you be allocating that today between stocks and bonds, for example?
I say for my average client, we're running about 50-50 stocks and bonds. Historically, a sweet spot has been about 60-40, 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. And for the last two or three years, actually, I've lowered that to about 50-50, and maybe even for my more conservative clients, maybe as low as 40% in stocks and 60% in bonds. I think that lower returns are coming in the U.S. stock market. I know we've had a nice recovery since the bull market resumed in October of 2002, and you know we've had some nice gains since then. But I take my cue from Warren Buffett, world's greatest investor, arguably, and John Bogle, the former CEO of Vanguard, who I think have made a persuasive argument in recent years that we're probably looking at subpar returns ahead, maybe on the order of 7 to 8% per year. And so accordingly, I've lowered my stock position from a normal, say, 60% down to about 45 or 50%.
Okay, just depending upon the aggressive nature of an individual client.
Right.
All right. And where are you putting your fixed income? Are you buying long-term bonds, intermediate bonds? Are you buying short-term paper? Where are you buying?
Well, I'm almost out of the bond market right now, which is the first time in the 21 years I've been managing money totally on my own. This is probably the lowest percentage I've ever had in bonds. I'm probably on the fixed income side, I'm probably only about 10 or 20% in bonds. And the rest of it, this is almost like a back to the future thing. I'm actually in 6-month CDs. I never thought I'd go back to, you know, good old stodgy, old-fashioned 6-month CDs, but I'm not buying them at banks. I'm buying them at a brokerage firm. There was a chart in the Wall Street Journal the other day, and it looked at the average bank 6-month CD, and the average yield was about 2.84%. But if you go to a big brokerage house like a Charles Schwab, a TD Waterhouse, an E-Trade, for a 6-month CD, you can actually get about 4.35% right now. So that's about 50% higher than the average CD at a bank. So for all of those listening out there, I would say call your bank. You know, see what the 3-month or 6-month CD is yielding, and then call your brokerage firm. I think you could probably get a better deal.
And I think it varies widely across geographic locales. As it turns out, in Champaign-Urbana, there are some pretty competitive rates. Not sure they're at 4.3 for 6 months, but they are reasonably competitive. And I see that national money market funds are really almost over 4%. The Vanguard Prime is over 4%. Fidelity cash reserves, 3.98, et cetera. So fairly close. So I'm sort of in your camp, John. I'm parking clients' money, to be honest about it, in something even more stodgy. It's not FDIC insured. It's in high interest-bearing money market funds at the moment. And I'm just sort of sitting on the sidelines wondering whether I'm missing this run-up as I see stocks moving up 4, 5, 6% for the year.
No, I don't think you're losing anything. In fact, besides the 6-month CDs, I'm also heavy in the Vanguard Prime money market fund. That would be my top pick of all the money market funds out there. It's yielding above 4%.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Theoretically, there is some risk in the sense that it's not FDIC insured, but practically speaking, there's virtually no risk. And I agree with you. If we can earn a little bit over 4% in a money-on-demand type of account, as opposed to buying the benchmark 10-year Treasury note and only getting 4.34, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Right. We can get bank CDs at over 4%, we can hunker down in a money market fund and get over 4%. Why go out 10 years in a bond and get only 4.34 and take some risk in the sense that if interest rates go up, bond prices go down?
I agree with you 100%.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Just real quick, I just want to come back to one point that you have now touched on, and that this goes to the idea of going to a brokerage for a CD. This would make me nervous because, as you mentioned, it's not like going with a bank. You don't have the federal insurance. Now, maybe you would say to yourself, well, if you go to a major brokerage company, they're not going to go out of business probably. It's probably going to be okay. But still, I would be nervous.
Well, actually, David, when you buy the security, you are buying FDIC-insured certificates of deposit.
Oh, so even though you're dealing with a brokerage firm.
That's right. The brokerage firm is going out and making the transaction direct with the bank. And these are called brokered CDs. So you have absolutely the FDIC insurance.
Okay.
So
well,
you never want to buy. You don't want to buy a CD that is not FDIC insurance. I agree with you there.
Yeah, that's right. For example, in my own personal portfolio, I just bought a CD through Bank Hapoalima. I don't even know where they are, and I don't even really care, because when Charles Schwab sent me my confirmation statement, it said right on there, FDIC insured.
Okay, good.
And in fact, all the brokerage firms sell nothing but FDIC insured CDs.
Okay, very good. Our guest this morning, David Sinnoh. He's with us once a month on the program to talk about money management, personal finance. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I and the College of Business. John Masetich is the owner of Kensington Financial. He's a professional money manager. He makes his home in San Diego, but also once a year he comes here to Champaign-Urbana to the U of I to teach a course. He's an adjunct professor of finance at the U of I. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's go to line one. Someone here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Interesting. What are adjustable rate mortgages pegged to? How does that work? And, like, is there a lag? They raise it after 6 months or something? And explain for the listeners what regress to the mean indicates, especially house prices. Schiller said he's found house prices track inflation and not much more. And where did he get his data?
Well, let's first talk about adjustable rate mortgages. Adjustable rate mortgages, typically when you go in and you purchase your mortgage to begin with, it is pegged off some national interest rate. Most mortgages are plugged and are a factor of the 10-year Treasury. So if we look at the 10-year Treasury today at 4.34 and you were to go out and purchase a conventional mortgage with a fixed interest rate to begin with, you'd be looking at about 175 to 200 basis points above the 10-year Treasury, which would put you somewhere between 6 and 6.25% as a fixed 30-year rate. With an adjustable rate mortgage, I always call those teaser rates, if you will, what really happens is that it is much more closely plugged and pegged to the 10-year Treasury. So it starts out significantly less than a conventional interest rate. However, as prime rate moves up, as Fed funds move up, an adjustable rate mortgage can move really 200 basis points or 2% in any given year with typically a 6% ceiling. And for people who have locked in adjustable rate mortgages over the last year or two, what they have seen when they have this annual renewal, that those rates have actually jumped the full 2% because of the enormous number of Fed funds increases that have taken place over the last couple of years. So that's really the adjustable rate game. Now, with respect to things regressing to the mean, I'll talk about that just very briefly. And that was the emerging markets. The emerging markets index, for example, as John pointed out, is extraordinarily volatile. That we, 1 year it might be up 40%, the next year it might be down 40%. But if we look at a large number of returns over a series of years, then we can determine what a mean return is. And what we find out is that there is tremendous volatility in that particular index. But eventually, most markets, if overall, if we take last year, that the returns in my couch potato portfolio was 12 and the average portfolio would be about 8 for really the couch potato, the things eventually are going to move back and get a lot closer to that mean rate of return. While in any 1 year there is a deviation from that mean rate of return, the bottom line is that if you are earning substantially in excess of that rate of return, well, things have this habit of moving back the other way. So I think that was your point, John. I'd be a little leery. REITs are probably the best example of all, real estate investment trusts. We've just had for the last 5 years double-digit rates of return year after year after year in these real estate investments. And we can, of course, talk about real estate, let alone real estate in California. But eventually things get back to a mean series of returns, which is based upon a very large or substantial number of years.
That's right. I'd like to address maybe the comment that the caller made about Professor Schiller about real estate tracking the inflation rate. I have a lot of respect for Professor Schiller. He's at Yale University, I believe, and He's the guy, I believe, who quoted the term irrational exuberance in the markets. And then I think Alan Greenspan picked up on that. Mm-hmm. He turned out to be right about the U.S. stock market. He predicted the crash. He was talking about the crash coming a year or two before it happened, beginning in March of 2000. When Schiller says real estate tracks inflation, that kind of implies that maybe real estate's only going to go up about 3 or 4% because that's what the historical inflation rate has been. But actually, real estate goes up. I've seen some figures recently that the average – if you look at the average single-family home in the United States going back over 30 years, it's averaged maybe about a 7% annual increase. So that's actually a little bit better than the inflation rate, which is averaged between – maybe between 2.5% and 3%. So I'm not sure what the caller meant by it, that real estate just tracked inflation. I think, in fact, over the long term, it's done a few points better than the inflation rate.
Okay. Well, let's hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Let's talk with someone else. Next is a caller in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Yeah. What about for this coming year? What do you see the possibility? I see the auto industry, and to me that's sort of an indicator that maybe the market might be turning to, you know, we might not have the growth or whatever. I think the auto industry is down, if I recall, or it doesn't look good at this point.
Well, for people who know me, I'm not betting on one particular industry. I just couldn't even begin to speculate as to where GM, Ford, and all of the subsidiary types of corporations are going to end up. If you're interested in that area, obviously you can buy a sector mutual fund. But that's just too dicey and too rich for my blood. So I don't even want to speculate there. I think what I might be willing to say, at least based upon early types of information that are available and following in on some of the comments that John makes, that it still looks like international markets are going to be stronger than U.S. markets for this year. And indeed, we're seeing a continual erosion of investments in the United States in the equity markets, and more dollars are pouring in, at least in the short run, into the international markets. And maybe that's having an impact of buoying up some of those markets as we see more dollars chasing those markets. But they certainly aren't as mature in some areas, and they maybe have a little bit more, shall we say, economics behind them, a little bit more wind at their back to run a little bit higher. So, again, I'm still very solid, at least having 30 cents of my dollar in those international markets.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Getting back to GM, I think your concern is warranted about GM. In fact, I have to admit that I just sold my GMAC bonds, and I sold them at a loss, and it really pained me to do that. But I just I didn't want to take the chance of GM going bankrupt in the next few years, which I think is a real possibility. But in terms of the overall stock market, I think it's important not to focus on the stuff that's in the news, you know, like GM and Ford every day or something, but to look at the overall corporate situation. Business Week does a pretty good job in tracking what's going on in the national economy. And the thing to focus on is the direction of corporate earnings. A lot of publications, Wall Street Journal, Business Week, talk about the growth in the earnings of, say, the Dow Jones 30 industrial stocks or even better, the 500 stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500 index. And right now, most of the prognosticators out there are calling for perhaps a 10% increase in corporate earnings this year, maybe a bit lower, but certainly no lower than about 8%. And that would be a decent year historically. In fact, the historical norm for corporate earnings is an increase of around 6 or 7%. So we're still actually running a little bit ahead of the historical norm of about a 7% increase in corporate earnings. And ultimately, you know, stock prices are determined by the increase in corporate earnings. So that's the thing to focus on when you're reading the stuff in the media. What's the direction of corporate earnings?
Well, why is there – I haven't heard anyone talk lately too much about bonds and stuff. Why are you sort of going this direction a little bit more?
You mean in terms of selling bonds?
Well, no, but in terms of the bond market, into the bond market, because for a while – you believe that maybe inflation is going to kick up a little bit, that kind of thing, or what's going to happen there?
Yeah, I personally think so. David and I were just talking about this morning. We both feel that the inflation rate is maybe understated on the national level. This comes out of the Consumer Price Index, comes out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And even Alan Greenspan, Fed chairman, feels that it's a bit understated. So last year
it was 3.5%.
Yeah.
The Wall Street Journal reported it as 3.5%. it affected me and impacted me in my personal life, and I'm guessing yours also, a lot more than 3.5%. Food, movies, gasoline, education. I can't recall anything that didn't go up at least that, if not more.
What's this other? I don't recall what the term is. The one that the bond that you can go, is that a bond or what is it, where you get inflation and the growth? What do you call that?
Yeah, the TIPS bonds, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And that's a good way to hedge yourself with TIPS.
Mm-hmm.
You will participate. You'll get a low yield. That's the unfortunate thing about TIPS. If you buy a TIPS bond today, intermediate term, you're only going to get about a 2-point-some% yield. But in addition to that, you'll get tacked on whatever the inflation rate is. Mm-hmm. So if the inflation rate rises from 3.4%, say, to 4%, you're going to get 4 plus the 2. You'll make about 6%.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a built-in inflation hedge.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hold that TIPS until maturity, it is guaranteed by the U.S. government, so there's no risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of folks put those, John, in pension plans and in IRAs, et cetera, so that they defer all of the income tax impact on the current yield on the bond.
Yeah, it's an excellent thing to hold in an IRA account or a Roth IRA account or your pension plan.
Thanks for the information.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have some other calls we'll get right to. Let me just introduce again our guests, Dave Sinnoh and John Macedich. Dave is here with us once a month on the program, always on a Friday, and we talk about personal finance and money management. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. John is an adjunct professor of finance. He is a professional money manager. His business is Kensington Financial. He lives in San Diego, but is here visiting to teach a course and has done that every year now for several years and has also stopped by here on the program. So the two of them together would, I'm sure, do their best to answer whatever questions people would have. I do also want to mention that Dave began the program talking about his couch potato portfolio of mutual funds. And indeed, if you'd like to see what those are, what the allocations are, go to our website, WILL.UIUC.EDU. Click on the Focus 580 section and then go to the links, and then you will see them. Just real quick, I have some other callers here, and I want to make sure these people know we will get to them. But I'm just curious about the total international index. Now, you have 20% of your money, so 20 cents out of every dollar goes into the total international index, and these are all Vanguard.
That's these are Vanguard indexes.
Vanguard,
right.
Indexes. Mm-hmm. And I know, as you said before, you're not necessarily saying Vanguard, but that's just – it's a convenient, mm-hmm, because they have a big family, and that means you have many different choices. How is that fund weighted?
Well, that's a great question. What really happens is that Total International Index is really a fund of funds, if you
right.
will,
right.
and it includes Europe, which is the majority of the asset allocation, practically about 70%. Is Europe, as I recall. Then we have the Far East. We have basically Japan. That's what we're really talking about there, about 20%. And then emerging markets is also in that total international index with 10%. So the truth of the matter is that I'm a little bit heavier. I'm really about 12%, if you will, in emerging markets. So it is a fund of funds, but you can look it up on Vanguard. You can go to Vanguard Personal Investors, click on index funds, and they have all of the index funds and all of the different price points with the index funds, the rates of return, 1 year, 5 year, et cetera, for life. Very easy, convenient website to utilize.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll also talk about another index you can easily follow. Just go to whatever browser you use and punch in the trading symbol EFA. This is based on the EFA index, which is Europe, Australia, Far East. And this pretty much tracks the Vanguard Total International Stock Market, with the small exception that it does not have any emerging market stocks. So EFA will track the developed markets of Europe and Asia. And if you just want to know just very quickly, how are the European markets doing today? Just punch in EFA, put it in your browser, look at it every day, and you'll know instantly if the index is up or down, that's how they're doing.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to next, a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. Line four. Hello.
Hi. May I ask about how institutional investment programs are affected by the start of the new year? Here's what I don't understand. Starting the first few days of January, the stock market rose strongly. Now, that happened in 2005, the first couple of days of 2005, the stock market rose strongly. And then the first week of this year, again, the market rose strongly. there had been good, high-quality stocks that had languished all through December. There had been optimistic predictions about the economy, but the stock market didn't budge. Then the first few days of January, the market rallies. I'm thinking, well, not there must be some institutional investment programs that wait for the new year. Is that correct? And if they do, why?
Well, I'm going to let John tackle that, but what you're really asking is a question of something that is called seasonality. And seasonality has been looked at over and over and over again. In other words, are there certain times of the month, are there certain months of the year where it makes more sense to either buy or sell? And, you know, I've looked at a lot of those academic studies, John, and usually more often than not, we see late December as a period of time where we have rising stocks. And this year, just the opposite happened. Not only did they languish, they actually ended a little bit down in that last 2 weeks of December. But when I've looked at all of these seasonality types of reports, the one I always liked best was the spaceship report on seasonality. And that's the one where NASA, every time they sent up one of those rockets in the air, about 9 out of 10 times that day, the stock market rose. So that's my notion of seasonality. But on a less humorous vein, do you want to jump in there?
And I wasn't aware of that rocket ship effect.
That's called the rocket ship.
I really
effect.
Have to look into that.
Yep.
Well, the caller from Bloomington is bringing up an interesting point. I think there is something to this effect. In fact, it's called the January effect. And it's been well documented in the literature, the January effect. And what happens is that every December, people look at their portfolio and they say, God, I've got all these losers. Why don't I just sell them and at least get a tax deduction for these dogs I have in my portfolio? So they sell the stocks, and therefore the stocks tend not to do so well in December because more people are selling than buying. But then in January, it's a new year. Most people are feeling a bit more bullish about the market, and they often buy these same stocks back, and hence the stocks go up. It's called the January effect. It doesn't work every year. But over a long period of time, it seems to have worked reasonably well. But I would conclude on this that I don't think you should put, you know, too much stock, no pun intended, on the January effect. It's just a 1 or 2 week phenomenon, and I'm not sure that it has any correlation with how stocks end up for the whole year.
Well, apparently then, as you're saying, there is a calendar effect on tax selling in December, but not necessarily any investment programs that have to wait for the new year to get started.
I'm not sure about the institutional programs. There could be some program trading out there based on the January effect. I wouldn't doubt if that's true. You know, maybe the Merrill Lynch and Goldman Sachs people have some program trading things going on. I'm not sure about that. But the January effect is definitely something that's been written about. It happens more often than not. But again, I don't think that you can really base an investment strategy on this very short-term phenomenon.
And also, a lot of the tax selling that takes place typically is completed before even the 15th or 20th of December. Usually people are back buying stocks late in the year, although that didn't seem to be the case this year. There are also some wash sale tax rules that say, look, if I'm going to take a loss on a position and sell it, I better not buy it back for at least 31 days. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to recognize that capital loss. So that ameliorates a little bit of the impact of the notion that, gee, I'm going to sell today and then I'm going to take my cash and buy it back tomorrow. But overall, when we look at all of these different seasonality trends, it's sort of a mixed bag, it seems to me, John.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Next is line number one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'm curious. I'm interested in putting some money into a Roth IRA, but I'm curious how to decide where to open an IRA.
Well, it depends a little bit on your risk tolerance. You have so many choices, and there are so many sponsors of Roth IRAs. Something as simple as a local bank. You can go to a local bank, and typically you can access any of their investment products. And the most likely investment product that you would utilize, of course, is a certificate of deposit or some other bank-denominated instrument. I more likely, with a Roth IRA, would choose either a large mutual fund family or perhaps a large discount brokerage firm. So you have carte blanche access to literally hundreds, if not thousands, of products. The problem with that, of course, is that you have to be cognizant of what really makes sense. So I think, first of all, you've got to ask yourself, how old are you to begin with? You sound very young.
Yeah, I'm 27.
Okay, so you're 27. Well, at 27, you have a long time to let this money work for you. And God willing, you'll live a very, very long life. So typically in an IRA, people don't remove their money from an IRA until at least 59 and a half. Of course,
right.
The beauty of a Roth IRA is that all of the gain, all of the earnings inside that Roth IRA grow tax-free, not tax-deferred. And
right.
Also, you need to open a Roth soon because then you have the five-year clock running. And once that five-year clock runs for a lot of people, and they start them as teenagers, you can access the first $10,000 of your Roth IRA, whether it's your contributions or whether it's earnings and contributions, and use that toward a down payment on your first home. So it really makes sense to start a Roth IRA when you are very young. Now, since you have so much time on your side, I would naturally lean toward being in some type of diversified equity investment, either some type of very, very substantial index, for example, or a very well-known growth mutual fund. That would be my choice. John, what do you think?
I would tend to agree with that, and I would also look at Vanguard. And by the way, David and I are not in on the payroll of Vanguard. We talk about them a lot, but you know, we definitely have an arm's-length relationship with Vanguard. But I would suggest you look at the Vanguard website, and I know for the IRAs and the Roth IRAs, they will waive the normal $3,000 minimum for a mutual fund purchase. I think in an IRA account, you can get down as low as $1,000. So for your $4,000 in the Roth IRA, you can actually have four different mutual funds at Vanguard. You could have maybe the Vanguard Total Stock Index Fund, which mimics the entire market. Again, that's the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund. You could have an international fund, which David has talked about. Maybe a bond fund, maybe the Vanguard Prime, whatever asset allocation you want. You could have at least four different mutual funds and be very well diversified just with that $4,000.
John, I'm not certain whether you can access now, if Vanguard didn't change their rule. I'd have to go back and check that, of whether you do need $3,000 to access one of their funds or $1,000. You may be up on that.
Well,
more
I think
than
for an IRA, I think they do lower the minimum.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, good. Does that help you out?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck.
Let's go on. Another champagne person. This would be line number three right here. Hello.
Is that three?
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh. I have two quick questions. One is, does the huge government deficit affect the stock market? And the second one is, you didn't mention Latin America in your international funds, and I wondered how that is.
Well, let's talk about that huge deficit, which is basically $8 trillion. And the way people are looking at that deficit, one, it's horrible because we have to pay interest on all of that money, and that interest could certainly be utilized better somewhere else, at least in our own economy, for example. So that is a problem, but people look at that deficit as a function of our GDP, our gross domestic product, which is approaching about $13 trillion annually. So when we divide as a numerator 8 and 13 as the denominator, we're really looking at, I think, about 60 or 63% annually. That's where that deficit is. So a lot of economists are arguing, yes, it's very, very large, but it's a function of our annual GDP. It's still manageable. So how it cuts, I'm frankly not an economist, not terribly certain, but it bothers me for a couple of reasons. One is a tremendous number of our treasury instruments. That's how we fund our debt. We have to issue IOUs, which are essentially treasuries. A tremendous amount of those treasuries are in the hands of foreign corporations and foreign governments. And politically, I don't think that's a good situation. In fact, one of our major trading partners, because of our balance of payment situation, obviously, is China. We import a whole lot more of goods and services from China than we export, which means that China ends up with a whole lot of our dollars. What does China do with these dollars? Well, for the most part, they put them back in the U.S. in the form of purchasing treasuries, and they essentially are funding our voracious appetite for spending, because we are deficit spending each year at the federal level somewhere between $350 and $500 billion. And that's just a cash-on-cash number. If we really looked at an accrual number, it's probably a great deal more. So all of those things don't bode well in the very long term. In the short term, I'm not sure how much attention people pay to them, John, and what impact it has directly on the stock market on any given day.
Yeah, probably in the short run, it doesn't have that much effect. In fact, right now, I think the deficit doesn't seem that bad. I think as a percentage of the GDP, we're running about 3-point-something percent.
How about Latin American, please?
Latin America, personally, I feel is troublesome right now. There's been a huge shift to the left politically. And I don't mean left as, you know, Democratic Party of the United States. I mean way left. We have the Prime Minister of Venezuela, Chavez, who is Castro-like in his economic policies. and Peru is shifted way to the left just recently. And Chile has gone to the left. It's very troublesome what's happening in Latin America today. So I certainly would have a very minimal amount of stocks in my portfolio from Latin America.
And I think what you're seeing in the emerging markets, while some of those countries are included in the emerging markets, when you look at the indexes, what you're seeing is people paring down dramatically their positions mm-hmm. in a number of these countries so that they have less and less exposure. Because the bottom line is that if you were going to invest in a country, you want some political stability. And the greater the political stability, the more financial stability that country has. And I think that's a huge problem in Latin America, regardless of how you feel about the politics of any given country.
Maybe I could even get back to that the deficit situation the caller brought up. In the short run, I would agree that, you know, probably over the next 2 or 3 years, the deficit is not going to loom that large in the financial markets. But beginning in about 2008, I've read that the baby boomers are going to start retiring en masse. Those people born between 1946 and 1964 start to retire and collect Social Security and go on Medicare. And from about 2008 to about 2015, the Social Security and Medicare system will go negative. They will take in far less money that they're collecting for the first time in our history. And that's the problem. It's the out years, so to speak, 2008 to 2015. We really have to do something about the problem before then. Otherwise, the deficit is really going to explode after 2008.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, David Sinno. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. And John Masetich, he is an adjunct professor of finance. He's a professional money manager from San Diego. Kensington Financial is his company. He's here visiting to teach a course at the U of I. And questions welcome. We'll see how many people we can get in the time that remains. Going next to someone over in Belgium by Danville, and that's line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Your one guest just started touching on what I'd like to talk to you about or have your comments about, and this is really more social than it is actually financial. Last night, my penny ante little party that I play in once a week, we all sat around and started talking, and we're in an area over here for the southern end of the Rust Belt. A lot of us were laid off back in the 80s and 90s when everybody had to have 15% return on their investments. And so everybody downsized and got rid of a lot of us, and a lot of us are now working a lot worse jobs, a lot lower paying jobs. And you wonder where I'm going at with this. Well, where I'm going at with this is that many of us are baby boomers. We're looking at retirement, getting very close, and we're all sitting around talking and doing. And a lot of us said, man, we can't afford the insurance. We can't afford to support ourselves and everything because we've got jobs that didn't pay the kind of money that we kind of thought we might have when we started into the 80s. And one fellow was talking, says, I don't have any money dealing with this, and I'm in a pretty tough situation. And we said, well, how's he going to deal? He says, well, I think I'm going to grow dope because that way I'll make a lot of money, and if I don't, at least if I go to jail, they'll take care of my health care. And I thought that was a very, very interesting perspective on the problem we're going to have, gentlemen, in that people don't have the money to go on, they don't have any resources left, and there's no really social program to take care of us, where these other countries you're talking about make big returns on the things, but yet they have social programs to take care of the people who have fallen through the cracks. And if you're always looking for 15% or 10% or the highest percent return, you really are forgetting a social problem that's going to come home, this Social Security thing, and even worse than that. And in fact, we had a Walmart discussion here earlier this week where we're sending money to China, just like you said. We've gotten ourselves in a horrible, horrible mess, gentlemen. What are we going to do about it?
Well, I think you've raised a number of issues, and I agree with you with most of what you're talking about. And that is that historically, certainly in the 90s, that wages have not kept up with the cost of living in America, and that a huge number of what otherwise were typical middle-class Americans did not participate in some of the wealth accumulation that took place in the 90s and well into 2000. And in fact, all of the statistics show that when we look at wealth accumulation, it is being held by fewer and fewer and fewer people. Now, interestingly enough, that was not the case in the 80s. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal very recently did a pretty solid analysis that showed that people in the 80s grew, and then it really hit in the 90s, and that with the exception of very high-tech positions and lots of education, or maybe if you were a movie star or a sports star, you simply didn't keep up, real wage growth was practically nil, 2.5%, falling far behind inflation. And you are exactly the issue that I'm talking about, that people who were formerly middle class who are now sort of finding themselves at the lower end of being middle class, that's one, it's bothersome, two, it's unfair, and three, it makes people angry. And it's going to put additional pressure on the political system. I don't have answers for you today, but I think it's a classic issue. There are tremendous numbers of Americans who are baby boomers who are in no position to retire. While there are a number that are, there are just even probably for every one there is, I'll bet, John, there are at least two or three that aren't. I mean, let's face it, with the exception of your residential home, the average amount of money that people have put aside in America among baby boomers is somewhere around $25,000. Now, you're out in California, of course, so maybe things look a little bit different out there because that's been just a huge economic engine for so many years.
I don't think it's much different in California. A lot of the people that I know are in debt up to their ears. They've taken on a lot of mortgage debt. They've looked at the equity in their home as a credit card, and they've extracted the equity by getting lines of credit and spending the money on SUVs and depreciating hunks of metal and whatnot. But I would like to get back to the caller's essential point. And I don't know, you know, this is very political, and I don't want to get too political, but here's my own personal opinion. I think that government spending has to be brought under control. I just read recently that over the last 5 or 6 years, the government, in inflation-adjusted terms, has grown by one-third. To me, that's just astounding. In just a five-year period, we've grown. Even adjusting for inflation, we've grown by one-third. So I think it's a paradox in the sense that I think we have to reduce we have to get government spending under control. And in doing so, we're probably going to hurt some people in the short run. But in the long run, I see that as probably the answer to get our fiscal finances in order in Washington, in the various state capitals. In California, we're out of control. It doesn't seem to matter who's in power. We have the Terminator as our governor now, as you know. And I was a big fan of his for a while, but I'm not such a big fan anymore because the government spending is just out of control in the state of California. You know, and we kicked out the last governor, Gray Davis, for that very issue, and now we're back in the same hole. So all I can say is you're not alone here in Illinois. It's the same all over the country.
And it's also true in Europe. I mean, let's face it, that we have an aging population for the most part in Europe, and the social programs and the social the social impact of those programs and the financial impact is dramatic as we have aging populations in Europe. So it's not so bright and rosy in Europe in those areas either, that governments are struggling with the amounts of resources and the amounts of money that must be dedicated to dealing with this elderly population. And it's just a huge time bomb in the United States.
Yeah, back to Europe. I think they're actually even in worse shape, caller, believe it or not. I travel to Europe a lot. I have a lot of European friends, and everybody is really talking about the same issues there. The German economic model is unsustainable. I have some German friends, and they admit that. It is unsustainable. They cannot take an unemployed person, let's say somebody in Germany has just lost their job, and pay this person 90% of a salary for the next 5 years. That's been the case in Germany. And now in Germany and in France and all over the continent and in the UK, they're cutting back on these lavish benefits. They cannot afford them either. And the Medicare, the health care expenditures are just exploding over there as well.
And, of course, at the same time, we're facing cutbacks by corporations who are freezing their pension plans. IBM, just to name the most recent. Can you imagine IBM, if you go to work for them now and you stay with them for 25 or 30 years, you're really into a 401k plan. You're saving on your own, if you will, as opposed to that promised pension plan, because corporations can't pay the amounts of dollars and can't fund the amounts of dollars necessary for these folks. It's going to put further burdens, further economic burdens on the system. Yeah.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're very close to being out of time. I'm going to try and see if we can get at least one more caller here, if we can be quick. And Ashmore, this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question about derivatives and also all the hedge funds. I notice, and I've been on the Internet all the time, there's continually all advertisement and hit the big jackpot, make all the money. And I wonder if this isn't a very, very bad danger.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's Wall Street's next debacle. And every time that we see some new investment that's going to be offered to typically the middle class investor or the investor who has $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, hedge funds are now being made available to these kinds of folks. I think it's very, very dangerous. They're very volatile. And it's an institutional game, in my opinion.
I would agree. I would say stay away from hedge funds. In fact, there's been some recent academic evidence the last 5 years that, believe it or not, hedge funds in total haven't really done all that well. They're barely ahead of the S&P 500 index, and yet they've taken enormous risk to make a return that's barely ahead of the market averages.
Okay. Well, I guess at this point we'll finish up with our thanks to our guests, John Zedich. He is the owner of Kensington Financial. He's a professional money manager. He lives in San Diego, but he's here at the moment to teach at the U of I. He's an adjunct professor of finance. Also, David Sinnoh, he's clinical professor of finance at the College of Business here at the U of I. He's with us each month. We do this program on money management to try to help you out, give you a little bit of advice, give you some things to think about. And as I said at the beginning, we want you to think very carefully about what you do with your money. Do your homework, do your research, get as many different opinions as you can before you make those decisions. And we've been doing this for a long time here just to be one of those places that you can go and get some answers and get some help. Well, thank you both very much.
Well, David, thank you. It's been lots and lots of fun. John, thank you very much. And thanks to all of the wonderful questions from our listeners.
All right.